This episode of the OrthoBullets podcast will go over the topic of concussions, or mild traumatic brain injury, from the knee and sports section on orthobullets.com. Let's start this episode with a quick summary. Concussions are a subset of mild traumatic brain injury, or MTBI, characterized by acute transient impairment of neurologic function, secondary to an impulsive force transmitted to the head. Diagnosis is made by careful neurological evaluation of an athlete following head trauma with a focus on cognitive function. Treatment is immediate removal from play, followed by cognitive and physical rest for 24 to 48 hours, and subsequent completion of a graduated return to play protocol. Now let's get into the episode. With respect to epidemiology, the incidence of concussions is 1.6 to 3.8 million sports-related concussions per year. This has been increasing over the past decade, though this is possibly due to increased awareness, and know that the substantial rise in youth athletes is concerning. Concussions also make up 5 to 9% of all sports injuries. In terms of demographics, traumatic brain injury, or TBI, is the leading cause of sports-related death. American football is associated with the majority of concussions, and know that concussions occur in competition more often than practice. Moving on to etiology, the pathophysiology involves a complex neurometabolic cascade resulting in the typical signs and symptoms of a concussion. Specifically, abnormal neuronal ionic flux will lead to headache, photophobia, and or phonophobia. Altered release of neurotransmitters like glutamate may lead to impaired cognition, amnesia, and slowed reaction time. And energy depletion in an effort to correct these underlying biochemical imbalances make athletes vulnerable to a second injury, otherwise known as the second hit phenomenon. Note that athletes that sustain a concussion may or may not experience loss of consciousness, and it's important to know that it is not required for diagnosis of concussion. Risk factors include sports with player-to-player contact, like football, wrestling, soccer, and basketball, which are all at highest risk. Another risk factor is prior concussion, and patients with a prior concussion are at 2 to 8 times higher risk of sustaining another concussion. Other risk factors include female, age less than 18, as well as mood disorders, learning disorders, and history of migraines, and these may complicate diagnosis and recovery. The guidelines for concussions to know include the International Conference on Concussion in Sport, which is a meeting held every 4 years, and focuses on the prevention, diagnosis, and management of sports-related concussion. This meeting generates a consensus statement summarizing the updated practice guidelines. The consensus statement was created at the first meeting in 2001, the grading system for concussions was removed in 2004, and all classification systems were removed in 2008. Newer assessment tools and timing of return to play was the primary focus of the most recent meeting. Now, let's talk about the presentation of concussions. Somatic symptoms include headache, which is the most common symptom and is present in 70% of concussed athletes. Types of headache include a myofascial tension headache, in which the pain is localized to the posterior neck at the base of the skull, and post-traumatic headache, in which pressure is localized to the forehead and or top of the head. Other somatic symptoms can include dizziness, balance problems, nausea and or vomiting, vision changes, as well as sensitivity to light, otherwise known as photophobia, or sensitivity to sound, otherwise known as phonophobia. Cognitive symptoms include feeling in a fog or slowed down, difficulty concentrating, and or forgetfulness. Emotional symptoms include lability, irritability, and or sadness. Other symptoms can include sleep disturbance, specifically change in the amount of sleep, either more or less, difficulty falling asleep, like insomnia, and or drowsiness. As far as signs of concussion, many sports have established mandatory signs of concussion. Presence of these visible signs dictates further evaluation and often removal from play. Note the specific signs and subsequent recommended action differs between sports. Again, know that loss of consciousness occurs in only approximately 10% of cases. Other signs include lying motionless, greater than 5 seconds, slow to get up, confusion or disorientation, clutching the head, amnesia, a vacant look, motor incoordination, and or ataxia. Moving on to the evaluation of concussions, let's discuss the sideline evaluation. So starting with the primary survey, remember your ABCs, airway, breathing, circulation, assess for spinal cord injury, and athletes should be placed in a cervical collar and backboard immobilization if needed, and know that in an altered patient, assume cervical spine injury until proven otherwise. Indications for transport to the ER for advanced imaging include deteriorating mental status, increasingly restless, agitated, or combative, severe or worsening headache, and focal neurologic findings such as unequal pupils, abnormal extraocular eye movements, as well as motor and/or sensory deficit. Other indications include neck pain or tenderness concerning for a cervical spine injury. It's important to remember that you do not leave a player alone after injury. The secondary survey will evaluate cognitive function. So any athlete with symptoms or signs of a concussion should be removed from the playing field and undergo immediate cognitive evaluation by a licensed healthcare provider. If no healthcare provider is available, the athlete should be removed from play entirely and urgently referred to a physician. A sideline assessment tool that tests attention and memory is the SCAT-5, which is the most commonly used. So now let's talk about the SCAT-5, or the Sports Concussion Assessment Tool 5, in a bit more detail. This is a standardized neuropsychological test for evaluating concussions in athletes age 13 or older. The Child SCAT-5 can be used for younger athletes. The SCAT-5 is composed of two parts, the immediate on-field assessment and the office or off-field assessment. So the immediate on-field assessment includes red flags, observable signs, whether witnessed or on video, the Maddox questions, which is a memory assessment, the Glasgow Coma Scale, and cervical spine assessment. The off-field assessment should be done in a private, distraction-free area, and can include the standard assessment of concussion or SAC test, as well as the balance error scoring system or BEST test. Moving on to imaging, advanced imaging is usually unnecessary, and the need for imaging is determined by the evaluating physician. Indications include acute head trauma with deteriorating mental status, increasingly combative, aggressive, and/or restless, focal neurologic deficit, as well as neck pain concerning for cervical spine injury. Other indications may include a history of subacute/chronic head trauma with persistent symptoms. Computerized tomography or CT of the head is most commonly used in the acute setting. Findings are normal in the vast majority of patients, however, it can identify fractures, intracranial hemorrhage, contusion, mass effect, and herniation. Finally, a magnetic resonance imaging or MRI of the brain has superior visualization of brain structures. Diffusion-weighted imaging, or DWI, is the most sensitive to shear injury. As far as findings, a standard MRI is normal in the vast majority, and remember that a concussion is most often a functional rather than a structural pathology. Functional MRI, however, can show increased cerebrovascular reactivity in the acute post-concussive period. Now, let's talk about some neuropsychological assessment tools. We'll go over the standard assessment of concussion or SAC test, the immediate post-concussion assessment and cognitive testing battery or IMPACT, the balance error scoring system or the BESS, the sensory organization test or SOT, the King-Devick or KD test, and the Sports Concussion Assessment Tool 5 or SCAT-5. So starting with the standard assessment of concussion or SAC test, this evaluates orientation, for example, what month is it? It evaluates memory, both immediate and delayed, for example, repeating 5 words over 3 trials and 1 trial at the conclusion of the assessment, and it also evaluates concentration, for example, repeating a string of 5 numbers backwards. Moving on to the immediate post-concussion assessment and cognitive testing battery, or IMPACT, this is a computer-based test that assesses verbal and visual memory, processing speed, reaction time, impulse control, and presence of concussive symptoms. A comparison is made to baseline scores or historical controls. It is a useful tool in guiding treatment and return-to-play decisions. Moving on to a balance error scoring system, or BEST test, this tests balance and postural stability by having the athlete perform 3 stances for 10 seconds each. This includes a bipedal stance, a unipedal stance, and a tandem stance. Moving on to sensory organization test, or SOT, this assesses integrity of the entire balance system by testing the vestibular, visual, and somatosensory systems, which are responsible for postural stability and maintenance of balance. The King-Devick or KD test examines saccadic eye movements, language, and concentration by having the athlete rapidly read numbers off a card from left to right for 3 successive tests. And finally, the Sports Concussion Assessment Tool 5, or SCAT-5, was reviewed under the sideline evaluation section earlier on in the episode. Now let's talk about treatment of concussions, which is non-operative. Options include immediate removal from play, and remember that same-day return to play is not indicated. Another option is cognitive and physical rest for 24 to 48 hours, followed by a graduated return to play protocol. So starting with immediate removal from play, indications include athletes of any age with signs/symptoms concerning for concussion. If concerned at all, remove the athlete from play. When in doubt, sit them out. Another indication for immediate removal from play is athletes with head trauma and no medical provider experienced in concussion evaluation that is present. Other indications include head trauma with a history of concussion, loss of consciousness, amnesia, positive exertional stress test, and symptoms lasting greater than 15 minutes. Moving on to cognitive and physical rest for 24 to 48 hours, followed by a graduated return-to-play protocol, the indications are for acute concussion. As far as the technique, remember that same-day return-to-play is contraindicated in patients diagnosed with a concussion. We'll go over the graduated return-to-play protocol in a moment. Remember that each step should take 24 hours, so an athlete should take 1 week to proceed through the full protocol and return to play. So stage one is symptom-limited activity, and the activities are daily activities that do not provoke symptoms. The goal is gradual reintroduction of work/school activities. Stage two is light aerobic exercise, for example, walking, swimming, or stationary cycling to maintain the heart rate at less than 70% of maximum. No resistance training should be done in stage two. The goal is to increase heart rate in this stage. Stage three is sport-specific exercise, for example, running or skating drills, however, no head impact activities. The goal of stage three is to add movement. Stage four is non-contact training drills. So the activity in this stage is more complex training drills, for example, passing drills, and patients may start progressive resistance/strength training. The goal of this stage is exercise, coordination, and improved cognition. Stage five is a full contact practice. Activity is normal training activities, and the goal is to restore confidence and assess functional skills. And finally, stage six is return to play, where the activity is normal gameplay. Now let's talk about prevention of concussions. We'll go over protective equipment, rule changes, community education, pre-participation concussion evaluation, and future research. So starting with protective equipment, know that headgear and helmets reduce impact forces to the brain. Helmet use is associated with decreased rates of head and neck injuries in certain sports like youth hockey, alpine, equestrian, cycling, and motorsports. As far as risk compensation, use of protective equipment may paradoxically increase injury rates by enabling more dangerous playing techniques. Moving on to rule changes, this is beneficial when a clear-cut mechanism is implicated in a particular sport. For example, upper limb-to-head contact is banned in American football, as it accounted for greater than 50% of concussions. In addition, now there is strict enforcement of red cards for high elbows in professional soccer. In terms of community education, players, coaches, athletic trainers, referees, and the general public should get educated about concussions. The focus is on safe play, identification of concussion, and appropriate graduated return to play. Know that minimizing premature return to play decreases the risk of long-term complications. Moving on to pre-participation concussion evaluation, this will take into account the number of previous concussions, type and severity of symptoms, as well as length of recovery. This will also evaluate the mechanism of injury. For example, low-impact injury but with disproportionately high symptom severity can indicate an athlete who is particularly vulnerable to injury. A pre-participation concussion evaluation is a great opportunity for education and modification of high-risk behavior. Future research of concussions include energy-absorbing artificial turf fields, genetic tests, for example, apolipoprotein E may be implicated, and specific playing techniques, for example, limited contact football and different tackling techniques. Now, let's end this review session talking about some complications of concussion. We'll go over second impact syndrome, post-concussion syndrome, intracranial hemorrhage, and chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE. So second impact syndrome is second head trauma before the symptoms of a concussion have resolved. This can result in a catastrophic cerebral edema resulting from loss of autoregulation of the brain blood supply. This has a high rate of death and disability with a mortality rate of approximately 50%. Second impact syndrome is associated with male gender, young age, and American football. Post-concussion syndrome is persistent symptoms of a concussion, for example, headache and confusion. This is greater than 10 to 14 days in adults and greater than 4 weeks in children. Return to play is contraindicated. Patients should undergo formal neuropsychiatric evaluation. And finally, use of pharmacotherapy is controversial. Moving on to intracranial hemorrhage, subdural hematoma is the most common form of intracranial hemorrhage. Patients with an epidural hematoma commonly have a lucid period before neurologic decline. Neurosurgical decompression and seizure prophylaxis is indicated in this setting. Finally, moving on to chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE, this is a progressive neurologic deterioration resulting from repetitive brain trauma. Symptoms include behavior changes such as loss of impulse control, aggression, and irritability, mood changes like depression, apathy, and suicidal ideation, and cognitive impairment, such as difficulty with executive functions, for example, carrying out tasks, memory loss, and dementia. The diagnosis is postmortem neuropathologic examination of the brain, which will reveal cerebral atrophy, enlarged ventricles, and diffuse senile plaques. Okay, so now that we've gone over the major points about this topic, let's go over a few questions to apply the information and get a sense of how this topic has been tested on past exams. The first question reads, a 45-year-old male retired professional football running back develops disordered cognition, memory loss, executive dysfunction, depression, apathy, disinhibition, and irritability. There is marked bradykinesia, tremors, and muscle rigidity on physical examination. What is the most likely diagnosis? And the choices are 1. Early onset Alzheimer's disease, 2. Parkinson's disease, 3. Amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, 4. Chronic traumatic encephalopathy, and 5. Frontotemporal dementia. The correct answer to this question is 4. Chronic traumatic encephalopathy. So the patient most likely has chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE, which is typically diagnosed postmortem with histopathologic examination of brain tissue. Given the patient's history and presenting symptoms, CTE is the most likely diagnosis. The exact pathologic mechanism of CTE is still poorly understood, but current theories are based on a series of repetitive diffuse axonal injuries leading to the buildup of tau protein, beta amyloid, and TDP43 proteins. Compared to Alzheimer's disease, CTE typically affects the superficial cortical laminae, specifically layers 2 and 3, as opposed to layer 3 and below. Despite there being a unique clinical presentation of CTE patients, there are no established neuropathologic criteria for diagnosis, with definitive diagnosis based solely on postmortem histopathologic analysis of brain tissue. Patients typically present in midlife with disordered cognition, memory loss, executive dysfunction, depression, apathy, disinhibition, irritability, and Parkinsonian symptoms. Gavette et al. Reviewed the clinical presentation, histopathology, preventative factors, and diagnosis of CTE. The author stated that tau protein accumulation is a unique histologic characteristic in CTE compared to other neurodegenerative diseases, as it is the most abundant aberrant protein identified. The authors concluded that intense research to identify biomarkers is necessary to detect disease, monitor progression, and develop therapies to halt or slow disease course. McKee et al. Reviewed 47 cases of histopathologically verified CTE. They described CTE consisting of memory disturbances, behavioral and personality changes, Parkinsonism, and speech as well as gait abnormalities. They concluded that CTE is a distinctive, slowly progressive tauopathy with a clear environmental etiology. To quickly go over the incorrect answers, answer 1, early onset Alzheimer's is unlikely in this patient given the age and history. The onset of symptoms before the age of 65 is considered early onset and rarely occurs in patients in their 40s. Answer 2, Parkinson's disease typically occurs in patients over 60 years of age. It is unlikely to occur in this patient given the age and history, but there are similar clinical characteristics. Answer 3, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis is the result of selective motor neuron cell death, resulting in progressive weakness without neurocognitive abnormalities. This patient does not have symptoms consistent with this diagnosis. And finally, answer 5, frontotemporal dementia is a possibility given the patient's age and presenting symptoms, but the history of professional football suggests CTE. Frontotemporal dementia commonly presents with behavioral abnormalities, impulsiveness, and loss of executive function. And moving on to the final question, which of the following players should be allowed to return to play on the same day they sustain an injury? And the choices are 1, a 15-year-old male soccer player who is struck in the head by an opponent during the course of play and experiences some initial confusion which resolves completely shortly thereafter. He has no headache, no memory loss, and is alert and oriented to person, place, and time. Answer 2, an elite 19-year-old female basketball player who is elbowed in the head, has a headache, no loss of consciousness, no memory loss, and is alert and oriented. 3. A 21-year-old male professional football player who has a helmet-on-helmet collision with an opposing player and is complaining of weakness and paresthesias in both of his hands. 4. A 12-year-old female baseball player who experiences feeling foggy after slamming into the outfield while attempting to catch a fly ball and cannot recall the event. And finally, answer 5, a 16-year-old male rugby player who experiences numbness, tingling, and weakness of his left arm after being tackled to the ground with a normal physical exam and complete resolution of symptoms by the time he gets to the sideline. The correct answer to this question is 5, a 16-year-old male rugby player who experiences numbness, tingling, and weakness of his left arm after being tackled to the ground with a normal physical exam and complete resolution of symptoms by the time he gets to the sideline. So the 16-year-old male rugby player who developed transient unilateral paresthesias and weakness of his left upper extremity likely sustained a transient brachial plexus neuropraxia, more commonly referred to as a stinger. He may return to play the same day as he has no signs or symptoms of a concussion and has a normal physical exam and no residual symptoms. A concussion is a disturbance in brain function caused by a direct or indirect force to the head. It results in a variety of nonspecific signs and/or symptoms, including headache, unsteadiness, confusion, loss of consciousness, change in personality, and amnesia. The acute presentation of concussion as well as the diagnosis of concussion is often straightforward and obvious, but it can also be subtle and difficult to discern. A number of standardized assessment tools have been developed to assist clinicians with sideline diagnosis, for example, Maddox score, and ongoing evaluation, for example, Sport Concussion Assessment Tool 3 or SCAT-3 of patients with a concussion. McCrory et al. Published a consensus statement on concussion in sport outlining the current understanding and evidence-based management of concussions. Although they found that there was a dearth of high-level evidence regarding optimal management of concussions, they unanimously agreed that no return to play on the day of concussive injury should occur. Petukian reviewed the diagnosis and on-field management of acute sport-related concussions. She concluded that although most, that is 80% to 90%, sport-related concussions resolve within 7 to 10 days, for some of these injuries, the time for complete recovery takes much longer. As such, she suggested it may be useful to consider a team approach to concussion management, with a variety of tools for evaluation and diagnosis, and consultants for treatment and management. To quickly go over the incorrect answers, answer 1, 2, and 4 are incorrect, as all of these players have signs or symptoms of concussion. As a result, none of these players would be cleared to return to play the day of their injury. And finally, answer 3, this athlete will require a thorough neurological workup to rule out a spinal cord injury and will not be able to return to play the day of their injury. That's all for this review about concussions. Hopefully that was helpful. This is the OrthoBullets podcast, a daily audio review session by OrthoBullets, the free learning and collaboration community for orthopedic surgery education. Keep in mind that these podcasts are designed to go along with the topics on orthobullets.com, and in fact, you can listen to these episodes right on the OrthoBullets website or mobile app while going through the topic. If you've gotten any value from the OrthoBullets podcast so far, please consider leaving us a 5-star rating and writing us a review on Apple Podcasts. It will help us spread the word and increase our discoverability tremendously. Thanks so much, and we'll see you all tomorrow.